message.
You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
Welcome, good evening, welcome to the late night One of Us review featuring Lawayne.
Hey, how's it going?
And here's Frank.
Hey ya.
And I'm Marco, your number two and MC here. I'm just the guy on the couch who's there to just be a punching bag and make the host look good. But tonight, that guy's not available. He died mysteriously, so I have been given the task of leading tonight's show. Hopefully, we'll have the best ratings in all of One of Us history, and hopefully nobody has to get hurt along the way. We are talking about a brand new, not really brand new, it came out in 2023, played a Fantastic Fest in South By, I think. It's been kicking around, but it's finally gotten a wide release. I'm talking about Late Night with the Devil, written and produced and directed by two Australian brothers named Colin and Cameron Cairns. I hope I'm pronouncing their name right. It's a found footage horror film set in the 1970s on the stage of a late night talk show hosted by one Jack Delroy, played by the very recognizable, I guarantee you, even if you don't know his name, you have seen David Dasmalchaine. He's been one of our busiest, most reliable character actors working. And here he's given a rare opportunity to be the first guy on the call sheet and be the lead. As we find out, Jack has got a very successful TV career, but his wife has passed away recently. The ratings haven't been good. He's constantly coming number two to, of all people, Johnny Carson, the real life Johnny Carson, who is long dead and does not appear in this movie. But they reference like, yeah, I'm never going to beat Johnny Carson. So
no,
sweet,
not.
Sweet night. No, you never will.
Nope.
Sweet, sweet 1977. He needs to make a big splash. So he decides that he is going to have a spooky Halloween themed show with featuring a medium, a spirit medium, a very amazing Randy type guy.
Yes, he was.
Very amazing Randy. Who's called in this one, he's called Carmichael, the Conjurer. Yeah. He also brings in Faisal Bazzi as Christo, a psychic. And his big, big feature, the big guest star, is a paranormal psychologist played by Laura Gordon. She plays Dr. June Ross Mitchell, and she is the doctor to a 13-year-old girl who is just known as Lily. And Lily is the survivor of a horrible sort of cult that everybody ended up dying. She is a survivor from it, but apparently they were making sacrifices to the devil or demons or whatever. And she's got one in her. And Jack figures, what's better for ratings than to talk with the devil live on TV? What could possibly go wrong? Guys, what did you think of this?
Loved it. Loved every single frame of this. Practically, you know, for the most part, I don't usually do this, but I see where I looked up the Wikipedia article before I saw this film, and I saw that it's sitting at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm like, well, okay. Sure.
Let's not go quite that crazy.
Let's see what you got. Yeah. Really, come on now.
The backlash will start immediately as of now. Yeah. I've already seen people online going like, "Do you know they use some AI imagery?"
I know
this?
Don't
watch this movie now. It's garbage.
Yeah, exactly.
It's garbage.
I really, I'm not the biggest fan of found footage. Mm-hmm. At all. I think as a genre, I was over it when the first time I saw it practically. But I think the way that this film uses the found footage device is very clever. It's basically what we're watching is like the master recording of this live episode, complete with like behind the scenes footage, and it has this really like rawness to it, and this like sort of spur of the moment spontaneity to it that you just can't get in other found footage films. I felt totally unsafe and not able to predict where things were going to go for the most part. I mean, the architecture of this film is very, very, very interesting. And
you know what it's getting to.
Yeah, exactly. But the architecture is really, really interesting the way it's laid out. And I think it's because of the way it utilizes the found footage aspect.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things about this versus, the found footage thing as a name almost doesn't make sense given some of the movies it's attached to, but that's a whole other argument. Here's the deal with this, though. A lot of the stuff that's classified as found footage borders on nearer improv, right? Or there's barely a script. Somebody spent a shit ton of time working out what they were doing with this, because this is my jam. I know all of the stuff in this. I'm like, oh, that's Randy. Oh, that's this thing. Oh, that's that thing. Did she just mention the Stanford Research Institute? I know what that is. The Bohemian Grove. They just call it the Grove in this, but it's Bohemian Grove. Right, like I know all of this stuff. I mean, I recognize that, and I recognize that. I started criticizing the psychic. I'm like, your cold reading skills suck. You need to let the family lead more. Also, fuck you, because you're cold reading people in grief. But like all of this, I'm like, I know what all of this is. I love all of this. This is my thing. It was I was just super excited watching it. But the biggest thing though is somebody thought about every element of this.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's the 70s. Oh, really? I never would have guessed, but it looks authentically 70s.
But it's also specifically late 70s, yes, which was the most like tumultuous part of the 70s. Right. And I love the way that the tension of society really, really creeps yes into this film in a lot of good ways. I mean, the you know, the stagflation, the gas lines, mm-hmm, you know, everyone knows what the late 70s were like. But
Jimmy Carter jokes.
Right. The Jimmy Carter jokes. Yeah, exactly. And I think that it is, you know, someone once called President Carter the symbol of lost American prestige. Mm-hmm. And I think that shows like this really were in that same sort of realm,
yeah,
because you could feel like the desperation everywhere, yep, even in entertainment. Like there was nothing that felt all right or normal.
Right, because he goes from chasing Carson to basically becoming Jerry Springer.
Yeah.
Right, like he starts bringing on like Nazis and dominatrixes and stuff because he's just not hitting it.
He doesn't even stop into Merv Griffin territory. He goes, you know, he just plummets. Yeah.
He just goes straight to the Springer. He's like, I got to get something that gets me over the top. And of course it doesn't work. And of course you find out about some of the other things he may have done to get where he is, which sort of plays into it as well. But it felt as genuine as any of these found footage type movies is going to feel.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm, the problem with a found footage film, of course, is always that it's always contrived. It's right, always a gimmick. What works about this, I think, fights against some of those problems is because it is filmed in a live studio audience. Mm-hmm. There are cameras there. It also means the cameras are, for the most part, locked down. Mm-hmm. So you don't have like the shaky cam that's so prevalent in so much found footage films. That kind of gives it a sort of classic quality that I think, and of course, it's also very treated to look, you know, like an older, a relic of an era, bygone times. It's got little glitches here and there. The premise of the found footage genre is that you're watching something that really happened. Mm-hmm. You're not watching a reenactor. You're not watching professionals. You're not watching something scripted. The minute David Dasmal Shane shows up, you're like, hey, that's that dude from Dune. You know, I remember that sure guy from Prisoners. You know, yeah, you could just go down the list. It's like, wasn't he an Oppenheimer? I mean, granted, everybody was.
Ant-Man.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, you have seen this man.
Oh, yeah.
He's great at playing like weirdos and creeps. This is a rare opportunity for him to be the lead of a film, mm-hmm, and carry it. But did that ever make you just go like, oh, this is pulling me out of the picture? Would the immersion have worked better with an unknown?
No, because I think because we have seen him so many times, and I've never seen him the same way twice, mm-hmm. unless it's a sequel, obviously. I really bought him as this character. I think the way he portrayed the hunger of the character really, really sold me on him. And the fact that he's always on, you know, he's always got that mask and that facade on, and he honed in on that type of persona, you know, like the guy who played the host of Family Feud, Richard Dawson. I kept on thinking of Richard Dawson when I was watching this. You know, he just had that fake sheen about him, mm-hmm. and he disappeared into this for me personally.
Yeah,
he
didn't take me out of it. I do agree, actually, because I mean, obviously, the character of Jack is complicated. There are more than one thing going on in his mind at any given mm-hmm. time. And Desmal Shane is not the first guy you think of as a TV talk show host who should be kind of genial and warm and, you know, is sort of big and, you know, all of these sort of like these characters we're talking about, mm-hmm. like, you know, Carson and so forth. He usually doesn't play that kind of charisma. As I said before, he's usually like a weirdo, a creep, mm-hmm. somebody who's got an edge to him. So putting him in that role is very clever because you kind of believe like, okay, yeah, he has a really high rating show. What if Jimmy Kimmel got up to some weird shit off air? I mean, he probably does. I don't know. When you have that kind of money, you just get weird with it.
Well, he hosted the Oscars, which is a pretty weird gig, if you ask me.
Desmal Shane actually is kind of cast against type, and it's one of those cases where it really does work and sell the performance.
One of the things about that is because he's been so many different things, it took me a while for it to register who that was. And by the time I recognized him, I'm like, oh no. Because then I was like, no, I've seen some of the people he's played. This is going to go badly now. it hadn't registered. So I bought him until I recognized him. And then I'm like, oh no, I already know that this is going to go terribly because that's the whole point of it. But like to realize, oh, but he's part of it. To me, that would be why you cast somebody like him in this, because he is just a little off.
Yeah.
And so when you realize as things get further along, what may have gone on with regard to his career, you're like, oh, yeah, yeah, I can see he would do that. It would suck for him, but he would do that because he's chasing Carson.
Yeah,
he just is.
Yeah, I mean, everybody was. And I did really actually appreciate that because another film might have just said, hey, let's just make up some fake rival, mm-hmm. Someone who's Carson-esque, but like actually name-checking Johnny Carson. And again, you know, for younger listeners, they may not be familiar with Carson, who did have these kind of people on his show, who had Uri Geller. Check mm-hmm. out... Johnny Carson basically destroys Uri Geller mm-hmm. with the help of the amazing Randy.
And Peter Popoff, where he takes a psychic or a TV preacher and basically just ruins them.
Yeah.
He shows everything that they're doing.
Yeah, right.
So it's so fitting. It's so perfect because we know Johnny Carson exists. We know these kind of things were showing up on the air. Mm-hmm, and because it was a time when a lot of folks, like Frank was saying earlier, there was kind of a malaise going through the culture, but there was also this sort of interest in other things like, you know, paranormal stuff.
Right.
That, you know, New Ageism, all these other sort of Eastern thought, you know, all of these non sort of traditional belief systems suddenly became like news. And mm-hmm. then, of course, once something becomes news, it's not a very long way to go for it to become entertainment.
And right. Exactly. Yeah.
By putting these mm-hmm. people on the air, some of whom are very clearly mentally disturbed, there's a real question of exploitation here because throughout mm-hmm. throughout the entire film, there are people telling Jack, you shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. We're messing with stuff we shouldn't be messing with. Mostly his sidekick, the character Gus, played by Risa Tori. I probably said his name incorrectly too. But, you know, he's sort of the guy who's there to just to be the punching bag, just to be made mm-hmm. fun of, mm-hmm. you know, but off screen, he's like, hey, man, I'm really actually kind of nervous about this. And they're like, just get the fuck out there and go smile and make people laugh and stop questioning it. And his
Jack's too far in.
Yeah, Jack's all in. And his producer's like, it's great. The studio head just called us and the numbers are going through the roof. Keep it going. Keep it going. And it's just this sort of sickening drive to just like keep pushing further when most people would have said, you know, maybe we're really hurting this girl by putting her on stage right now and having her go through all these contortions.
A great performance by that actress, by the way, who even when she's not channeling the devil, when she's possessed by the devil, even her normal state is off-putting in a very, very intriguing way. I just,
I mean, she's really channeling Linda Blair is what she's channeling.
Yes.
You know, but it's all the Exorcist tropes. But, you know, as Frank said, you know, she's creepy even when she's not being obviously possessed, which Linda Blair was like a cute little girl when she's not possessed by the devil. This girl is just weird, you know, right from the jump. She's just fucking weird.
Hi, Jack.
Well, she was raised by a cult, so they make sure to to bring that in. Exactly. Like, this was never a normal child.
Which is such a great touch because, God, the rise of cults, Satanism, and, you know, religious movements,
were just all of that
through the roof in that decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's really what this show has going for it, because it's more than just a premise. I mean, you could have done this in a contemporary setting. It's like, oh man, you know, we're going to get so many hits on our podcast when we interview the devil. But by setting in this era, that specificity of it really does help the found footage concept, because here's one of the things I don't like about found footage generally, in that it feels like a cheap way to make a movie, both artistically and financially, because nowadays all of us are carrying a little movie studio in our pocket. You know, we can just whip out our phones and film anything. But by setting in the 70s, you know, again, they're using the video cameras in the studio, so they're not going to be shaky. And also, this stuff would be on YouTube in seconds. But back in the day, you had like tape traders and people collecting ephemera and behind the scenes bloopers and stuff. So it does make it feel like an artifact from that era. Like this was forbidden, something you should have never seen. But
like, did you see that tape? Have you seen, like, you know, it's almost like, you know, you had to be there type of energy.
Well, and using your modern example, if it was a YouTube video or whatever, like, nobody would believe it. They'd be like, oh yeah, because you just do this thing with CG. But this is ostensibly a live studio audience production, which means everybody can see everything that's happening. And that little girl is floating and doing weird shit. And nowadays you'd be like, well, yeah, man, that's After Effects. But 1977, you'd be like, what in the fuck is that?
And I think that that's one of the things, another one of the things I liked about this was this really is a testament to practical effects. You know, I mean, it's there are genuine shocks, and because it's a live TV factor, even though here in the YouTube era, that certainly got into my brain that this was a live. I treated this as if I was in the audience, as if I was watching this at home on TV, and I think the audience reactions really only amped up the scares, the effects of the scares, and the tension. All throughout, every time I heard like "ooh ah," you know, it's like, I mean, it was palpable. Yeah,
the Haig character, the amazing Randy substitute, he is annoying as fuck. Every time I've ever seen Amazing Randy give interviews over the years, he recently passed away. He always seemed very polite. He seemed very kind of like, you know, skeptical, deeply skeptical of fakers. You could even see it on the Johnny Carson interview with Uri Geller, where he's being really nice. He's like, hey, man, I would love nothing more than for this to be true. And, you know, the guy's making excuses like, well, I'm just not feeling it today, because they made sure he couldn't use any of his tricks on camera. Mm-hmm. That happens here, except the Haig character is such a fucking dick. He's so obnoxious. Yes. But to Frank's point, because it's in a live studio setting, you do get like these forensic moments where they're like, wait, play that back.
Yes.
Play back what we just saw. And there are moments where you start to question, like, wait a minute, is everybody hallucinating this, or did this really happen?
Right. Yeah, that's another really great element of that is we all just had this experience, did we?
Yes.
Go back and watch the tape. Let's double check and see what that really looks like. But that's the other thing about this being from that era as well. This is the type of shit that if my dad was watching it, like, you know, I'd already be in bed because I'm a kid at the time. But like, if my dad was watching this and the shit was going on, I would have heard him and I would have come out to see what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
And you don't have that when you're sitting watching some dude on YouTube.
No.
Not only that, that dude on YouTube may get millions and millions of views, but not everybody is watching it at once. And this is the other thing.
Yes.
You got to remember, back then, there were like three channels. I mean, Jack is pissed because he's number two. But remember, there's like three channels, which means there's three late night shows.
Yeah.
Basically, that's it. And Carson dominated, which meant almost everybody in America was watching the exact same thing at the same time. And if something, oh, I don't know, if you were going to try to, say, possess an audience through the medium of television, the best way to do it is to get them all watching at the same time. They're like, this motherfucker still hasn't clicked my... Would you please like and subscribe so we can jump into your soul?
Right. Dude, if you wanted to possess all of America using subliminal messages or something from a television, just air whatever you're doing during the final episode of MASH.
You're
going to have like 75% of the people on the in the country are watching it at that moment.
Yeah.
The whole communal experience of television just doesn't exist like that now. And that's why I think it was brilliant and clearly a sign they were thinking to set it when they did, because it gives you so many opportunities to do things that you just wouldn't do now. They just wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start going into our final thoughts? Frank, would you kick us off, please?
Sure. So I think we're all basically on the same page here. And this was one of the most refreshing, innovative, and telling horror films I've seen in years, And there have been some good horror films in the last few years. I thought it was very well paced. It was very well scripted. I think it straddled the line a lot between, you know, a late night scare extravaganza and a genuine like fright fest. I got scared. Like there are times I did not want to look at the screen, and yet I could not stop looking at the screen. I think it's a well crafted horror film. It's also a comment on, like we alluded to, the influence of mass media as a source of not just communication, but a power. You know, these shows, these hosts, these producers, they held America in the palm of their hands, largely for years. And this is the time that this film is set in is really when everything was coming to a head. Outside of the television screens and the way that they, you know, merge, at least in this film, was just fascinating to me. And it showed how far these shows would go, how far the creators and the hosts were willing to go. And you can call it lack of scruples or just a fearlessness or just like desperation. But it was of that moment and it signified that moment. And, made for a really great horror film. So I am going to go ahead and give this, because I got really no notes, 10 out of 10. 10 out of 10 times I'd watch that episode of Seinfeld where Kramer buys the set from the Merv Griffin show and puts it in his living room. It's just when the whole gang comes over, they're all sitting around just talking about their days, but he's like interviewing them like he is Merv Griffin. So 10 out of 10 times I'll do that. I'll watch that episode.
I know you're lying, because when the next time we go to your house, you're going to have it set up like the Night Owl set.
Exactly.
Yeah, with the sliding panels.
Dude, I want one of
and
those.
I'm going to get some polyester suits as well. So, you know, watch out.
LaWayne?
There was a lot wrong with the 70s. but TV in that era was insane. And this captured all of, like, In Search Of is going to be about this same era, right? So all of that paranormal supernatural stuff is starting. The stuff that's on every third cable channel now is just beginning to really do it. You know, you, the ancient aliens and all of that other crap and the Satanism and all of that stuff. I was a kid when this movie would have taken place in 77. So I've seen variations of this stuff. All of it felt insanely real. And like I said before, I'm like, oh my God, that's this thing. Oh, that's that thing. I know what that is. That thing. Because I love all this paranormal bullshit. I don't believe any of it. But I love all of this stuff. Like, I know about Bohemian Grove. And I know about why the Stanford Research Institute is not the same thing as the Stanford University. And I know Randy. And I can complain about the cold reading skills of their shitty psychic. And, like, I know all of this stuff. This is, like I said before, this is my jam. Like, if I never saw another found footage film, I would be okay. This is superb. I'm not as in love with it as Frank, but I'm close. I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5 Mystic Owls.
I mean, I'm close to both of you guys in terms of, you know, my appreciation for this. I think we've talked about how it makes very good use both of a premise that is usually not my favorite, but actually ties it into something larger that was happening in the culture at the time and finds a smart way to develop that into the thematic content of the film itself. It's not just about found footage. It actually has something to say about the medium and how television was used in that time and how it was so prevalent and effective. And to Luane's point, it kind of shows how these talk show hosts, they kind of had to start amping things up as competition got rougher. Cable was coming in. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of other things. Now, suddenly, it wasn't enough to just bring in, you know, some well-known beloved star. You know, you had to start getting kind of fucking weird and just kept pushing the envelope and just trying to do more and more outrageous things. And that raises some questions of, like, where is the line? David Desmalchain is, you know, like I said, it seems odd at first that, you know, that someone so familiar would be involved because it could potentially undermine the premise of the film. But the character of Jack needed somebody who could play all those levels and still have an edge to them. And he does a great job here. I mean, he is one of the best character actors we have working right now. And it's nice to see him have a chance to shine and still bring his sort of weirdness to what he's doing, but also make Jack kind of oddly relatable and sympathetic, even though you suspect that he may be involved in something far worse. If I have any complaint, it's just that I didn't find it that scary, unlike Frank. I found it very entertaining, and I found it, you know, to be very effective and very smart. I was expecting bigger scares, to be honest.
Okay.
But I still had a good time with it. I mean, I don't think you're going to be, you're not going to walk away from this traumatized or anything. But no. I think you're going to have a really good time. And I really wish I could have seen this in a theater with an audience.
Yes!
Because that just adds that extra level of, you know, you're a member of an audience watching the audience and you start to feel, because very often they're talking to you, the audience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very much the audience perspective. I can only assume that watching this with in a packed theater is only going to enhance that experience for you. Definitely highly recommend it. Just wished it was a little scarier. I am going to give this 8.5 out of 10 sacrificial daggers. That just happened to be lying around.
They're just there. They're just there. What are you gonna do? I got to say, after I finished this, I had this weird combination of like exhilaration and exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
Did you too?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Not just me.
Yeah, and but the thing is, it's not even 90 minutes. I think it's barely 90 minutes long. This is short, it's tight, and yet it's a slow burn. And because of the way it's set up, they're like, oh, let's cut to a commercial break. That, you know, what ends up happening is those are kind of like the act breaks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a very neat setup for that. And then finally at the end, you're like, oh, this is what's really going on. I didn't find it a huge surprise, but I just had a good time watching it. And it's just smart and fun. And boy, I wish I could watch that with a packed crowd for the first time. For those of you who are going to watch this in a theater with a lot of people, for the first time, I envy you because I think you're going to have a great time at the movies. I really do envy them that experience, and I don't envy people very often, and certainly nobody envies me. Well, that's our show for tonight, folks. Come back tomorrow. We'll be joined by the amazing Doug Henning and his illusions, and the musical stylings of Donnie and Marie. Just imagine I'm doing a sweet golf swing just the way Johnny Carson used to do whenever he was ending his monologue. Thank you and good night. Da-da-ba-ba-da, ba-da-ba-da, ba-da-ba-ba-da, da-da-ba-da.